This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hi, I'm Mickey Vandeleau, and this is USA Today, dated Friday, May 3rd. Let's get started. Who is Timothy Mellon, the ultra-wealthy donor bankrolling both RFK Jr. and Donald Trump? Aaron Mansfield and Rachel Barbel, USA Today. Timothy Mellon, an ultra-wealthy political donor bankrolling Donald Trump's super PAC, is also giving millions for Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the third-party candidate who has been blamed as a potential spoiler in the 2024 presidential race. It's an unusual arrangement that Democrats have highlighted as they seek to paint RFK Jr. as someone far more closely aligned with the Republican ex-president's Make America Great Again movement than with causes on the left. Many Democrats say that Kennedy, the son of a former Democratic senator and nephew to a former Democratic president, could help elect Trump if some voters cast ballots for him as an alternative to President Joe Biden. Trump has also suggested Kennedy helps him. Kennedy's platform includes defunding the war in Ukraine, a position popular on the far right, and reinvesting that money into public child care, something more popular on the left. He advocates to seal the border, a key talking point on the right, but frames the situation as a humanitarian crisis. Mellon is heir to the family fortune of banking and industrial magnate Andrew Mellon. He has donated to many anti-immigration measures and was a major contributor to a Texas-led fund to build a wall on the southern border with Mexico. Since 2023, the donor has given $20 million to the super PAC that supports Kennedy and $15 million to the super PAC that supports Trump. He backed Trump in 2020. But Mellon doesn't appear to have switched his allegiance. Instead, over the course of 9 months, he gave $5 million donations that alternate between American Values 2024, which supports Kennedy, and Make America Great Again, Inc., which backs Trump. For example, Mellon donated to American Values on April 10, 2023, followed by MAGA, Inc. on July 10th, records from the Federal Election Commission show. He donated again to American Values on July 20th, and then to MAGA, Inc. on August 16th. The donations continued through January. Stephanie Spear, press secretary for the Kennedy campaign, says the campaign does not communicate with American Values or keep track of its donors. However, Mr. Kennedy is pleased that donors from diverse positions on the political spectrum are supporting his candidacy, Spear said. Prior to his run for president, Kennedy was prominent in advocacy against vaccinations, including the coronavirus vaccine. That position lines up more with Republicans who are significantly less likely to get the vaccine, according to the Brookings Institution. His platform includes a proposal to put federal funding into studying the health effects of pharmaceutical products, policies to expand home ownership, and invest in black businesses. He also describes his ties to prominent Democrats like his uncle, John F. Kennedy Jr., and Hispanic labor activist Cesar Chavez. Trump's campaign declined to comment. Efforts to reach Mellon through a nonprofit organization were unsuccessful. Is it unusual? Yes. Is it shocking? No, not at all, said Daniel Weiner, the director of elections and government at the Brennan Center for Justice, an advocacy group on democracy law based at New York University. Ideological overlap between Trump and Kennedy. Kennedy trails far behind both Biden and Trump. Members of the Kennedy family rejected his campaign and formally endorsed Biden in April. But polls from 538 show Kennedy with the support of around 10% of eligible voters. While Democrats say he could siphon votes from Biden, survey results give mixed indications on the degree to which he might also take some votes away from Trump. A poll in March shows Biden beating Trump in a head-to-head race, but losing to Trump when Kennedy was on the ballot. An April poll showed Trump beating Biden in a three-man race with Kennedy. Weiner said donors backing third-party candidates is an old pattern. He said if those backing Trump perceive Kennedy's candidacy as taking more votes from Biden than from Trump, then they are likely to believe boosting Kennedy's campaign might give them more bang for their buck than giving more money to Trump. Of course, there is also some ideological overlap between Trump and Kennedy, so it's possible that that is the reason, though typically in those cases, major donors just pick the person they prefer, Weiner said. Matt Corradoni, spokesperson for the Democratic National Committee, called Kennedy a spoiler in the race and said it was not a coincidence that he and Trump share a donor. Mellon, who lives in Wyoming, is known for maintaining his privacy and is rarely photographed. He is an amateur pilot who has invested in and led transportation-related companies, including Pan American World Airways. Forbes estimates that the Mellon family is worth some $14.1 billion. Mellon self-published an autobiography in 2016 that used racial slurs, criticized Black people who use social service programs, and compared the use of these programs to government slavery, according to the Washington Post. USA Today did not independently review the book. A book by the same title, Pan Am Captain, is due to be published by Skyhorse Publishing, another American Values donor, in July. The design shows a quote from Kennedy on the cover. Tim Mellon is a maverick entrepreneur who embodies the most admirable qualities of what FDR called American industrial genius. Brendan Glavin, deputy research director for the money and politics organization Open Secrets, said it's one thing for a donor to back one candidate during a primary election and switch to supporting another during the general, but that a donor simultaneously backing two is unusual. He said that Kennedy's national name recognition and his ability to pull votes away from both major presidential campaigns could make him a uniquely appealing spoiler for donors to back. The question in the end will be, will he continue this? Glavin said. That will be something to watch as we get into the summer. Is he feeling like this strategy is working? Glavin added that the hyper-competitive era we are in, where elections are decided by small margins, combined with a post-Citizens United world, has led to an increase in big money trying to influence politics. He said that some say there should be a stricter enforcement of existing rules around super PACs, and others argue that new rules should be put in place about how they operate. There's nothing really looking forward there to stop this from progressing, Glavin said. Donald Trump trial live updates. Testimony to continue on Cohen hush money recording. Aisha Baghchi, USA Today. New York. The 11th day of Donald Trump's New York hush money trial will see a computer forensic analyst retake the stand after jurors heard an audio recording yesterday that the analyst extracted of Trump and Michael Cohen discussing a hush money deal. So what do we got to pay for this? $150, Trump asked on the recording. That was a reference to the $150,000 that a tabloid company ultimately paid to keep former Playboy model Karen McDougal's story of a romantic affair with Trump quiet ahead of the 2016 election, according to prosecutor Matthew Colango's opening statement in the trial. The prosecution and defense may find more that they want to introduce on Friday from the extraction of Michael Cohen's phone. Judge Juan Merchan may also issue a ruling on whether Trump has violated a gag order four more times. Merchan already determined Trump violated the order nine times. Merchan appeared particularly skeptical at a hearing Thursday of the Trump legal team's defense of Trump commenting on the jury, which he said is likely overwhelmingly filled with Democrats. Could Trump go to prison? Trump could theoretically face a couple decades in prison if convicted on all 34 felony counts. However, several legal experts told USA Today a more realistic sentence, assuming that worst-case outcome for Trump on the 34 counts ranges from merely probation to up to 4 years in prison. What is Donald Trump on trial for? Trump faces 34 felony counts of falsifying business records. Prosecutors say he falsified records to cover up unlawfully interfering in the 2016 election through a $130,000 hush money payment to porn star Stormy Daniels. Daniels has alleged she had sex with Trump in 2006, a claim he denies. Interstate 95 will be closed for days in Connecticut after fiery crash damages bridge. Crystal Nurse and Tayo Nagayan, USA Today. Officials expect Interstate 95 in Connecticut to be closed for several days after a gas tanker was involved in a multi-vehicle crash and exploded early Thursday, causing a traffic shutdown in both directions on the busy highway. The 5:30 a.m. accident involving a tractor trailer and another vehicle caused the gas tanker to erupt into flames and damage an overpass above the interstate in southwest Connecticut, according to Connecticut Governor Ned Lamont. Norwalk Mayor Harry Rilling said no serious injuries or fatalities were reported from the crash. Travelers were advised to avoid the area near the interstate's Norwalk exit, Lamont said during a Thursday news conference. Traffic in the area was snarled, and the northbound and southbound lanes near the exit remained closed as of Thursday night, according to the Connecticut Department of Transportation. The bridge was damaged. The heat from the burning fuel compromised some of the bridge, so that bridge is going to have to come down, Lamont said during a news conference Thursday evening. That demolition is going to start first thing tomorrow morning. Photos and videos posted on social media by the Norwalk Department of Police Services show the tanker engulfed in flames underneath a bridge. The department didn't immediately respond to a request for comment from USA Today. Lamont said authorities hope to reopen the major highway for two-way commuting as early as Monday morning. The governor also declared state of emergency, which will help expedite some of the resources needed for us to respond to this situation. Connecticut DOT Highway Operations Bureau Chief Paul Rizzo encouraged motorists to take Interstates 87 and 84 as alternative routes and asked commuters to either work from home or use public transportation. Interstate 95 is used by more than 100,000 drivers in the state per day as of September, according to Connecticut DOT's traffic data. The highway connects New York City to Connecticut and Rhode Island. Connecticut overpass sustains significant damage but still stable. Connecticut DOT Bureau Chief and Chief Engineer Scott Hill said the overpass near where the explosion occurred sustained fire damage but is stable. He added the bridge isn't near collapse, though he doesn't know the full extent of the damage. Certainly, we're not going to let traffic over it, he said. Although the overpass was less than 10 years old, according to Connecticut DOT Commissioner Garrett Ucalito, it sustained pretty severe damage due to the amount of gasoline that was in the tanker truck when it burst into flames. Gas from the tanker causes steel within the bridge to overheat and warp, Ucalito added. William Turner, State Emergency Management Director, said that during the news conference, the fire was extinguished. About 6,500 gallons of fuel was burned in the fire, he said, and state environmental agencies are investigating the foam and gas runoff that flowed into the nearby Norwalk River and to empty the remaining 2,000 gallons of gas in the tanker. Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg confirmed on X the U.S. Department of Transportation's highways team is working closely with the Connecticut DOT in the aftermath of the explosion. Overpass demolition to start Friday. Demolition of the overpass will begin around 3 a.m. on Friday, and crews will lift the bridge out, which could take 24 hours or longer to complete, according to Lamont. Structural engineers also determined that the roadway will need to be repaved before it opens. Officials urge people to stay home and to avoid the section of the interstate affected by the fire. Lamont advised those who have to travel to use the Metro North Railroad, which will have additional rail services. Norwalk Public Schools will be closed on Friday as authorities deal with ongoing traffic issues. Fear hovering over us. As Florida dismantles DEI, some on campuses are pushing back. Laura Papano, Hechinger Report. Boca Raton, Florida. It doesn't take much searching to spot the fallout from the newest Florida law seeking to erase DEI, or diversity, equity, and inclusion, from public campuses. One example, the staff offices at Florida Atlantic University Center for Inclusion, Diversity, Education, and Advocacy in Boca Raton are vacant, with desks abandoned and LGBTQ+ flags, posters, and pamphlets left behind. Elsewhere on a campus framed by palm trees, the Women and Gender Equity Resource Center remains, but a laminated paper on the door offers a new identity, Women's Resource and Community Connection Division of Student Affairs. In Florida, which along with Texas has the most extreme anti-DEI laws in the country, virtually all DEI staff have been fired or reassigned and offices shuttered. But that's not the only story. There's also mounting resistance to the laws. Students have devised workarounds like camouflaging FAU's annual homecoming drag show as Owl Manor, nodding to the school mascot. Mary Rasura, a senior, launched an LGBTQ+ newspaper, Out FAU, saying it just seemed like a no-brainer. You know, we are still a community, like we're still here. And while some wary faculty members have recast lectures, others have boldly not done so. Professor Robert Casanello at the University of Central Florida in Orlando, one of the nation's largest college campuses with 70,000 students, warned in red ink on the syllabus for his graduate seminar on the civil rights movement, as for all courses he teaches, that he will expose you to content that does not comply with and will violate anti-DEI laws. Casanello feels compelled to object. My area of research is Jim Crow and the civil rights movement, he said.
being told not to discuss institutional structural racism, that's like, what would be the point of me teaching, you know? I might as well just go home. The pressure to dismantle DEI programs in higher education has caught on. The Chronicle of Higher Education's DEI tracker identifies 85 anti-DEI bills introduced in 28 states since last year, with 13 becoming law. And though conservative activists like Christopher F. Rufo say DEI efforts are an affront to colorblind meritocracy, Brendan Cantwell, a professor at Michigan State University who studies politics and policy in higher education, argued that there is nothing ideological about how DEI offices operate. Their efforts are very bureaucratic and institutional, he said. Cantwell said DEI shows up in tasks such as student advising or ensuring that databases accommodate gender identities and meet federal regulations, efforts that have risen over the past decade as a direct response to campuses growing more diverse, racially and in other ways. DEI efforts also cover veterans, first-generation students, international students, members of the LGBTQ plus community, people with disabilities, and people of different faiths. The aim has been to institute policies and practices that allow all students to feel accepted. But now, anti-DEI laws are reaching beyond attacking such functions and seeking to control what may be taught in college courses. We are fighting over whether or not political parties that are in control of state government, in control of Congress, can control higher education, Cantwell said. This is not about regulating funding or financial aid, but what people learn and how colleges and universities can serve their students and staff. That was apparent in January when the Board of Governors for Florida State University System, in approving regulations for the new anti-DEI law, also removed sociology from the list of courses that meet general education requirements. On the social platform X, Education Commissioner Manny Diaz berated sociology as woke ideology. For Professor Michael Armato, the sociology undergraduate director at UCF, eliminating the general education credit for his discipline was upsetting enough. Introductory sociology enrolls 700 to 800 students per semester. But more disturbing, he said, was the absolute silence on the behalf of our administrators who failed to defend the field or challenge state meddling in campus curriculum. What's next, he said, noting that fields like literature, anthropology, and psychology also grapple with issues of race, gender, and sexuality. There is this sort of fear hovering over us, said Armato, raising concerns for what we can teach, for what we can advise students about. As a result, his department now allows faculty assigned to teach potentially hot subjects like race and ethnicity to bow out. It's their neck on the line, he said. Yet he is not backing down himself. He's prepared to teach a graduate course that includes critical race theory. I refuse to kowtow to attempts to have me not teach what is the accepted and documented evidence within my field, he said. Last semester, he taught a course, Beyond the Binary. Still, Armato wonders, is this going to blow up on me? Certainly, it's easy to spot worry on campuses. At UCF, the student government counts on staff members to run an annual diversity training. The staffer responsible for it said he was unsure if it could happen. We are waiting on guidance, then ignored all follow-up emails. Across the state, more than a dozen campus leaders, including administrators, faculty representatives, staffers, and student leaders who were contacted, declined to be interviewed about DEI or even to answer questions via email. Some apologized, as one did after initially agreeing to an interview, saying, "This is a very sensitive state subject for state employees." Some sources spoke only on background. In teaching, Casanello has a latitude that others don't because he has tenure. If I were a lecturer and I see what's going on in Tallahassee, he said, I would say, maybe I don't teach that concept. Marissa Bellinger, one of Casanello's graduate students, was warned by a visiting professor teaching a lecture course on American history for which she is a teaching assistant. He said, you know, be careful of students asking you questions to get a rise out of you, to get you to say something that will get you in trouble, she said, speaking outdoors in a shaded spot on campus. I mean, if he's worried about you, that says a lot. Bellinger from Tampa is studying for her PhD at UCF and has weighed leaving the state but would want to return to teach at the campus. But then it's like, what is there to teach, she said. You know, I'm going to be censoring myself. Such calculations are shaping Grace Castellan's plans. Castellan, a senior and the president of the UCF chapter of the NAACP, sees professors avoiding certain discussions. They offer comments like, "Oh, guys, you know, so the law, I really can't say too much on this," she said. Or as another did, adding a disclaimer about not trying to impose any beliefs on you guys. "It's frustrating. It's like we're not getting the full course content," Castellan said. She plans to go out of state to attend graduate school in public policy. "I applied to 7 schools. None of them are in Florida," she said. "If I stay here, I'm not going to learn the content that I need to know without it being censored." It is this kind of worry that spurred Michael H. Gavin, the president of Delta College in Michigan, a 2-year institution, to start Education for All a year ago. The group gathers 175 higher education leaders, many of them community college presidents, to monitor attacks on DEI and coordinate support through an online discussion list and regular meetings. Gavin, who wrote a book on white nationalism and politics in higher education, said it is critical for leaders in states not facing anti-DEI laws to speak for those who cannot. "Let's not get tricked into this notion that we have to somehow be quiet about things that are right in our domain, like restricting curriculum topics and banning books," he said. He added that anti-DEI attacks are particularly damaging to students in community colleges, many of whom are from marginalized groups, because the rhetoric is about their very identity. But even as homepages for DEI offices are redirected or show error messages, services may still exist. For example, the University of North Florida in Jacksonville dissolved all DEI-related offices, but one JAX, which had run UNF's Interface Center for 11 years, became an independent nonprofit. Elizabeth Anderson, the executive director, said the group hired the same leader who is continuing to serve youth in an interfaith capacity on campus. Anderson finds the anti-DEI landscape absurd. "The idea that diversity, equity, and inclusion have been co-opted to be bad words is bizarre to me," she said. A sense of outrage fuels Carlos Guillermo Smith, a policy advisor for Equality Florida and a former state representative now running for the state Senate. Smith, a UCF graduate, helped to lead a large protest on campus last spring. Smith is campaigning to support abortion rights, affordable housing, and college affordability, and to hold DeSantis' administration accountable. Despite the clampdown in Florida, Smith said he sees no choice but to speak up and push back. "Resistance, public pressure, and litigation are the only paths to counter the far right's extreme agenda of censorship and control," he said. "I'm committed to that fight for as long as it takes."
"I'm a student who was arrested at a Columbia protest. I am not a hero, nor am I a villain." Ali Wong, opinion contributor. Tuesday night, 2 dozen Columbia University students linked arms in front of the student-occupied Hamilton Hall at dusk. I was one of them. We sang with broken yet mighty voices. "Your people are my people, your people are mine. Your people are my people, our struggles align." We were a group of activists of differing faiths and none, friends and strangers united, linking arms with one another and, in spirit, with the generations of courageous students who came before us. Electricity crackled through the air from the growing protests echoing just beyond the university gates, gates I had just moments ago slipped through and sprinted from like a bat out of hell. We knew we were likely to be arrested for being on campus despite the university-mandated shelter-in-place order, but we chose to run into the fire anyway. As a human chain, draped in keffiyehs and shaking like leaves in the autumn wind, we sang with hushed tones and breathed deeply as hundreds of New York police officers armed with flash grenades and pepper spray marched toward us like a military parade. As they approached from multiple directions, we sang with frail and crackling voices. "This love that I have, the world didn't give it to me. The world didn't give it, the world can't take it away." As officers threatened student journalists with arrest, presumably to ensure minimal coverage of the aggression they were about to exert. Students in dorms craned their necks and shakily stretched their iPhones out windows to observe the impending attack. We clung together to one another as they approached us and seized us like rag dolls and slammed us into the hallowed ground of brick and concrete. But unlike rag dolls, we bleed, we crack, we bruise, we feel. Police at Columbia were anything but professional. Once dispersed, I held my hands up to show I was neither resisting nor armed. In response, I was handled brutally by police, along with other students being shoved down concrete steps, saying with shameless condescension, "Watch your step." We were arrested, bound, and shuttled down to one police plaza where the New York Police Department had a pizza party prepared for arresting officers.
They threw us in cells like animals, cells where the only toilets women could use lacked any privacy, and where our naked bodies were in plain sight to throngs of male officers. During news conference hours later, New York Mayor Eric Adams said there were no incidents of violence. This is an abhorrent lie. Later on Wednesday, in an email sent to the entire university community, Columbia President Manoush Shafiq thanked the NYPD for their professionalism. This supposed professionalism is also a lie. What is nonviolent and professional about seizing a compliant 120-pound student with her hands up and slamming her to the concrete ground? What is nonviolent and professional about treating students so brutally? What is professional about reviewing a woman's hijab during police bookings and refusing to return it, yet offering me, a non-Muslim, my vest because the jail cell was cold? What is professional about forcing women to expose their genitalia to male officers in order to use the toilet because we trespassed on our own university? We sang, like a tree planted by the waters, we shall not be moved, as our bodies were seized, but we would not be moved. Protesters aren't anti-Semitic. Our hearts are with innocent Gazans. Our hearts are with Gaza. Our resolve is stronger than ever, and we hope the world sees the brutality of the police against peaceful protesters at the behest of our own university president. But make no mistake, we are not the heroes of this story. That honor belongs to those in Gaza, those whose families have been starved, whose cities have been bombed, whose children have been slaughtered, and those who did not have the privilege of choosing arrest or offering their bodies up as a public relations sacrifice. Nor are we villains. Those are the perpetrators of slaughter, such as Manoush Shafiq and the Board of Trustees, who would rather beat and arrest students than divest from a foreign government committing genocide. On Saturday, I hosted a Passover Seder at my cramped Manhattan apartment for many of my closest friends. Representing many faiths and none, we broke bread together and celebrated the Jewish liberation from slavery and a broken, unjust system of oppression. On Tuesday, I was shackled and arrested as part of the campus movement that many in the news media are calling anti-Semitic. It isn't. Critically, our fellow Jewish students are not the villains in this story. They are our friends, our family, our blood, our fellow foot soldiers. Like us, they bleed, they crack, they bruise, they feel. At no point have the student organizers called for or promoted violence against our Jewish brothers and sisters. We are calling to end the violence and genocide against our Palestinian brothers and sisters. I choose to risk arrest because, unlike many of my classmates and friends, I'm privileged enough not to face deportation. Because my potential suspension and any other consequences that may befall me does not even register on the scale of suffering experienced by those for whom we sing, whose lives have been taken, whose children have been slaughtered, whose families are being starved and tortured, those whom Columbia University is complicit in killing. We are not the heroes, nor are we the villains. The latter category belongs to Columbia and the broken system it refuses to heal. Could two wealthy, opinionated thoroughbreds owners reverse horse racing's decline? Dan Wolkin, USA Today. Louisville, Kentucky. A short path through the Churchill Downs backstretch connects the barns of Todd Pletcher and Brad Cox, trainers who annually come to the Kentucky Derby with some of the top three-year-olds in America. Between Pletcher's fierceness and Cox's duo of Just a Touch and Catching Freedom, there's a decent chance one of them will be celebrating with the Blanket of Roses come Saturday night. On a typical Derby week walk between those two barns, which are always constant hubs of activity, you'll hear no shortage of opinions about who's looking good, who's been training poorly, and who's going to win the race. But this week, if you know where to look, a more interesting conversation is taking place between regularly dressed, highly successful businessmen with insanely deep pockets, unbridled ambitions, and a plethora of opinions on how to reverse horse racing's decades-long decline. One of them is Mike Repol, who rose from an entry-level job in the beverage business to co-founding the companies that pioneered Vitamin Water and Body Armor. His passion project as a thoroughbred owner has led to large-scale success at the highest level of the game, except in this race, where he hopes fierceness will turn around years of terrible luck on the first Saturday in May. The other is John Stewart, who progressed from an hourly line worker at Toyota to management and eventually private equity. After years in the game as a serious handicapper and gambler, he decided last year to jump into horse ownership and has spent tens of millions in a short period of time to build Resolute Racing, with more purchases coming at a head-spinning pace. At last year's Breeders' Cup, he met Sheikh Fayyad Al-Thani of Qatar Racing, a relationship that led to Stewart purchasing 25% of Just a Touch shortly after his debut in January. Both of these men talk bluntly about the problems in horse racing. They both have lots of ideas about how to fix them. And at the end of the day, they have both invested massive amounts of money into this because they truly love the sport. They just see things through a different lens, and their rivalry has played out on social media where they've argued in public, taken pot shots at each other, posted memes about each other, and even seemingly made up recently, at least for a little while. Trash talk on social media. How did their beef begin? Repol has jokingly, or maybe not so jokingly, appointed himself commissioner of horse racing while announcing last October that he was launching and funding a national thoroughbred alliance in an attempt to unify various factions of the sport. In March, Stewart posted a long essay on X, formerly Twitter, saying that racing's problems can't be solved by a single person or a commissioner, appearing to take a direct shot at Repol. Repol responded on X by calling Stewart an arrogant, free-spending new kid on the block and shallow rich guy. From there, their public back and forth devolved into more nicknames, sarcastic poems, talk of $8 haircuts, and Photoshop pictures of the two of them interacting in strange ways. Just a couple of regular loudmouths with an affinity for social media who happen to have millions upon millions to play among the world's elite. What I have against Mike is he's going down this approach like Donald Trump and Elon Musk have. Like, you know, creating controversy and attention, and I don't think that's what the sport needs, Stewart said. It's not like the sport got into trouble with one thing. It's been years of things, and it's actually just lack of sophistication. I've been, like, overwhelmed with lack of sophistication on certain aspects of the sport. Said Repol, I've had backlash before for things I've done, but this is just, like, common sense. There's no systems and processes in the sport. No one has figured out how to put it together. I think there's, like, 10 major spokes on the wheel of racing, from breeding to sales to racing, and everybody wants 90% of the spokes fixed. But don't fix mine. Nobody wants to be the first spoke that gets replaced or repaired. And getting to the next step has been tough. I think it takes someone who's vocal. I think it has to take someone who's obviously a big player in the game. And then someone who doesn't give a blank whether he's liked or not, because I don't care. I know I'm doing this for the right reasons. The thing is, horse racing needs both of them to be leaders and innovators, not just because of their purchasing power or social media prowess, but because they did not come from and are not beholden to the thoroughbred industry's stodgy, elitist old guard. And maybe, at least on the big picture stuff, their ideas aren't actually that far apart. In lengthy conversations with both of them this week that centered on the future of the sport, it was interesting that they both brought up Formula One. This week, Repol had been walking around with a documentary film crew for an unspecified, self-funded project that can maybe turn into something akin to the Drive to Survive series on Netflix. Repol has talked for years about horse racing having a public relations problem and thinks the focus on horse deaths, as tragic as they may be, is out of balance with the reality of what happens on the backstretch, the care that is given to these majestic animals, and continued improvements in safety. Part of how you improve racing is you try to show a different side of racing that people don't see, he said. Here, nobody wants to do it. But as Stewart points out, F1 didn't turn around its business just because of a TV show or publicity, but rather a holistic change in the way the sport engaged with fans after being purchased by Liberty Media in 2016. One small example, if you go to an F1 track, you can buy merchandise associated with your favorite driver or racing team. Why isn't horse racing doing the same, he wonders. And F1 doesn't even have the biggest inherent advantage that horse racing does, gambling. Imagine, for instance, different kinds of prop bets or parlays where you could go to the track and wager on how many races your favorite jockey, trainer, or owner might win on a certain day. It's not just about money. It's little ways to get your small dollar or young fans emotionally invested in people. There's lots of issues, but lots of opportunities, Stewart said. The industry doesn't have one problem. The industry has 1,000 problems, and it needs 1,000 tiny solutions. Contrary to most new owners who want quick satisfaction from the auction ring to the racetrack, Stewart's buying philosophy is focused primarily on broodmares and regenerating strong bloodlines in American racing that he says have been depleted by sales to overseas interests. He has lots of other ideas he's pursuing too, ranging from the development of a portable CT scan machine that could quickly look at horses' legs before and after they run, using AI to help identify precursors to breakdowns, to individually packaged meals for his horses that would potentially eliminate contamination issues that cause positive drug tests. These are athletes, right? Stewart said. If you have a grade one winning stakes horse and you have a claimer, they're getting the exact same nutrition. It makes no sense. This could end up being a whole business, right? I look for industries all the time where things are disrupted. A good investor doesn't go where everybody else is going to make money. They go where everybody else thinks they can't make money, and that's where they go to make money. The board game that comes with no instructions. Beyond the social media barbs and personal rivalry, there's real substance and value to having both of them in the game at the highest level. What Repol has that Stewart doesn't, though, are the scars of an industry that has been undeniably difficult to change and a sport that has seen its share of billionaires come and go. Horse racing is this incredible board game that comes with no instructions, he said. Sometimes an owner will come in here with money and latches on to somebody and wants to spend $10 million and 2 years later gets nothing and says, man, I should have bought a yacht. Repol, to his great credit, has not walked away despite plenty of heartbreak and frustration, especially here in the race he most wants to win. Not only are Repol owned horses 0-for-7 in the Derby, with fifth place being his best finish, he's had to scratch the favorite twice the day before the race, including last year after Kentucky Horse Racing Commission veterinarians evaluated Forte's bruised right foot and deemed him unfit to run. I was frustrated for 24 hours, Repol said. I've done this my whole life as far as taking chances, taking risks with business and being in horse racing, and you learn some more sometimes through adversity or losing than you do through winning. There's a reason why things happen, and here you are a year later with the Kentucky Derby favorite again. Given their passion for racing and affinity for disruption, Repol and Stewart are both likely to be part of the Derby picture and the sport's political future for years to come. Last month at a horse auction in Lexington, Kentucky, they took a smiling picture together and posted it to X, where the commissioner introduced Stewart as the Repol Stable Fan of the Month, a lighthearted nod to their disagreements. In turn, Stewart announced that Repol had made a significant donation to the poker tournament he was organizing for Derby Week to support Thoroughbred Aftercare. Maybe together they can figure out how to fix horse racing after all. Nude cruise to set sail from Florida next year. Here are the starting costs, itinerary. Natalie Nasa-Alund, USA Today. The big nude boat cruise, which allows passengers to bear all, yes, even at the buffet, is set to sail from Florida next year. The 11-day adventure to the Caribbean is set for the first 2 weeks of February on the Norwegian Pearl, according to the Bare Necessities Tour and Travel website. Bare Necessities' newest nude cruise is a private island double dip with a brand new travel partner, the company wrote on its website. The trip, which embarks from Miami, includes an exclusive visit to an idyllic private island in the Bahamas, as well as another exclusive stop on the way back to the port of Miami. Two opportunities to enjoy a new slice of paradise, coupled with a beautiful selection of Eastern Caribbean island stops, will make this a can't-miss big nude boat experience, the travel company posted. Big nude boat cruise sailing dates and destinations. The ship departs from the port of Miami on February 3rd and returns to the same port on February 14th. The itinerary includes stops at the Bahamas, Puerto Rico, St. Martin, Dominica, Martinique, and St. Lucia. How much does a big new boat cruise cost? Rates for an inside cabin start at $2,000 per person. They stretch as high as $33,155 for the top room on the ship, a Haven three-bedroom garden villa. Laws of the land and sea. Guests are encouraged to park their bare behinds on towels provided on board in areas including the pool deck and the buffet areas, according to the website. Passengers can easily follow our rule on nudist etiquette by always placing a towel down before sitting, it reads. Remember to pack a swimsuit. Not all excursions are clothing optional. Who will Donald Trump choose as his running mate? What to know as the potential VPs gather in Florida? David Jackson and Zach Anderson, USA Today. Washington. Former President Donald Trump will spend part of his weekend hosting the latest episode of The Apprentice, but this time it's the vice presidential edition. At least six contenders for the former president's running mate, Senator Tim Scott, Republican from South Carolina, Senator J.D. Vance, Republican from Ohio, Senator Marco Rubio, Republican from Florida, Representative Elise Stefanik, Republican from New York, South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem, and North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum will attend a Republican donor retreat Friday and Saturday in Palm Beach, Florida, in what looks like a series of auditions. This is a wonderful opportunity for Republican leaders and supporters to come together, says the invitation to the event, which will also include panel discussions featuring campaign officials and Republican lawmakers that are closed to the press. But in Palm Beach, most eyes will be on the vice presidential candidates who have been trying out for months at campaign rallies, primary parties, meetings, and television interviews to join Trump on the GOP ticket that back in both 2016 and 2020 included Mike Pence. Trump, who liked to keep contestants guessing when he hosted The Apprentice reality show, has been throwing out mixed signals about his running mate in recent months. Anyone claiming to know who or when President Trump will choose his VP is lying, unless the person is named Donald J. Trump, senior campaign advisor Brian Hughes told USA Today in a statement. Here's what you need to know about Trump's potential VP picks. Tim Scott. If Trump seeks a historic pick, he could make Scott the Republican Party's first black vice presidential candidate. Scott, who once competed against Trump for the 2024 Republican nomination, ultimately hit the campaign trail for his formal rival in the New Hampshire and South Carolina primaries. On the other hand, Trump has also suggested he doesn't want an heir apparent running mate who has designs in the 2028 presidential election, and Scott could fall into that category if he decides to launch another White House bid. That's the reason prominent figures like former Secretary of Housing and Urban Development Ben Carson keep popping up. Carson is not expected to launch another White House campaign, and he's not scheduled to attend the donor retreat this weekend. Senator J.D. Vance. Vance, a first-time senator, has been particularly vocal about defending Trump against his indictments in four separate criminal cases, including the ongoing hush money trial in New York. A frequent television news guest, Vance's VP stock rose this week after reporters obtained an invitation showing he will head a fundraiser for the former president in Cincinnati on May 15th. Vance is also friends with a key figure in Trump's orbit, Donald Trump Jr. Vance told Fox News and CNN this week that he has not talked with Trump about the running mate position. Of course, if he asked me, I'd have to think seriously about it because I think it's really important that he win, Vance told Fox News Sunday. Representative Elise Stefanik. Trump could also make history by picking a woman, and Stefanik has been on his potential list for months. A member of House leadership, Stefanik endorsed Trump early, campaigned aggressively for him in New Hampshire, and often speaks to conservative groups like the RNC Donor Conference this weekend in Palm Beach. Stefanik has also been a vocal critic of Trump's criminal cases, to the point of filing a legal complaint against Special Counsel Jack Smith. He is a lead prosecutor in the cases alleging Trump mishandled classified information and tried to steal the 2020 election. Senator Marco Rubio. Rubio, a senator from the state where the conference is being held, would also make history as the first Latino person on a national ticket. A Trump-Rubio duo might also have a legal problem because they both live in Florida. Some attorneys believe that running mates from the same state might be forced to forfeit that state's electoral votes. That's why running mate Dick Cheney moved residency from Texas back to Wyoming when former President George W. Bush tapped him in 2000. The Florida problem might also affect the chances of another GOP lawmaker and potential running mate who plans to attend the donor retreat, U.S. Representative Byron Donalds, Republican from Florida. North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum. There are always long shot candidates. Think former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin in 2008, and Burgum is one of the speakers at the weekend soiree. Trump could consider the fact that the North Dakota governor endorsed and spoke on his behalf at an event the day before the Iowa caucuses. Burgum has been more enthusiastic for Trump than other former 2024 candidates who are not being considered for running mate, including Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley. Another politician not on Trump's current list, former Vice President Mike Pence. Pence turned against Trump over the latter's 2021 demand that his vice president try to throw out the electoral votes that elected Biden to the presidency, a step Pence insisted he never could have legally taken. Trump has also appeared indifferent after mobs threatened Pence's life as they invaded the U.S. Capitol building on January 6, 2021. South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem. Noem will appear at this weekend's conference at a fraught time for her vice presidential prospects. A story in her new book about shooting the family dog because it kept attacking people and livestock. The story prompted criticism from Democrats and Republicans. Donald Trump Jr. on his show Triggered called the incident not ideal. In an interview with Fox News host Sean Hannity, Noem said, "It's an unfortunate situation, but one that I hope people understand.
They need to hear the truth and not what the media has been spinning. Plenty of advice for Trump. As he assesses his options, Trump is getting plenty of advice from associates, lawmakers, and donors about who he should pick as his running mate. Some of the potential choices are not scheduled to be in Palm Beach this weekend, including Arkansas Governor Sarah Sanders, a former Trump press secretary, Texas Governor Greg Abbott, and former Republican Tulsi Gabbard. On his radio show, Donald Trump Jr. told former Trump advisor Steve Bannon that his father should accelerate the running mate decision, especially given the fact that Trump is tied up in court. "You've got a deep bench to do it," Bannon replied. "You've got great people, J.D. Vance, Governor Burgum of North Dakota. You know, you've got Dr. Carson, others." Others said there's no telling when Trump will make his decision. Newt Gingrich, who Trump considered for running mate back in 2016, said the former president will act when he's ready. "I'm relaxing and watching to see what Trump does. He will only do it out of intuition," Gingrich told USA Today. "I suspect that he's looking at Marco Rubio, he's looking at Scott, Tim Scott, and I think he's probably looking at a couple women candidates, but I think he's going to think it through at his own pace. I think he is in no hurry." Are Airbnbs banned in Hawaii? New laws seek to crack down on short-term rentals. Kathleen Wong, USA Today. Airbnb listings and other short-term vacation rentals in Hawaii are one step closer to being phased out as the state grapples with a housing crisis exacerbated by last year's wildfires on Maui. A bill with the potential to reshape vacation rental regulation across the state passed the Senate and the House on Wednesday and it now awaits Hawaii Governor's Josh Green's signature, who had already promised to sign it if it hits his desk. If signed, the new law will go into effect on July 1st. SB 2919 would grant each Hawaii county the authority to redefine zoning ordinances, including converting short-term rentals into long-term residential housing, in order to guide the overall future development of the county. Those who violate the law would be charged a fine of $10,000 per day. Significant change won't happen overnight, but it is the first major legislation regulating short-term vacation rentals statewide, according to Hawaii Senator Jarrett Kehoe-Loli. Kehoe-Loli, who introduced the bill. "It's huge," Kehoe-Loli told USA Today. The bill actually overturns a 1957 ordinance that drove Native Hawaiian communities from their home and converted their land into sugar plantations. "Many of the other zoning ordinances are outdated," Kehoe-Loli said, "and don't reflect the influx of foreign investors or over-tourism. We know the majority of STRs, short-term rentals, in Hawaii are legal, owned by non-residents, and contribute to skyrocketing housing costs," Governor Green posted on X, formerly Twitter, last week. "We support Senate Bill 2919 to empower counties to regulate STRs and potentially phase them out." Housing affordability in Hawaii has worsened over the past two decades. A single-family home cost four times as much in 2023 than in 2000, and less than one-third of households can even afford the typical local home, according to the Hawaii Housing Factbook by the Economic Research Organization and the University of Hawaii. Rents also continue to rise, and Maui has the most expensive median rent in the state. A typical apartment is $2,500 a month. Part of that is due to the high percentage of short-term rentals in Hawaii's housing stock. About 30,000 of Hawaii's 557,000 total housing units, or 5.5%, are short-term rentals. Compared to cities like Las Vegas, where only 3% are short-term rentals, the report said. It's even worse in Maui, where vacation rentals account for 15% of the island's total housing supply. August wildfires, which destroyed the majority of Lahaina and displaced thousands of West Maui residents, only amplified the housing crisis on Maui. With Lahaina, we're in an emergency situation. Jordan Rudis of Native Hawaiian-led community organization Lahaina Strong told USA Today. "The fire burned away the majority of our working-class housing," she said. "We're in shambles, and people are still waiting for long-term housing." Rudis said around 3,000 displaced residents are still living in hotels over 8 months since the fires ravaged West Maui. Some are leaving Hawaii entirely due to lack of stable long-term housing. What's become clearer, at least in Lahaina and that outlying community, is that so much of the housing stock on that part of the island has been converted into vacation rentals that the survivors are struggling to find places to live, said Kehoe-Loli. Maui County Mayor Bisson said that
he wants to increase the inventory of available long-term units for people of Maui and even proposed tax incentives for owners to convert their units into long-term housing in November. It's not an inventory problem. It's the fact that the inventory is being used for something that's not helping the community, said Ruidas. Whistleblower who worked for Boeing supplier Spirit AeroSystems dies after short illness. Nathan Diller, USA Today. A whistleblower who worked for Boeing supplier Spirit AeroSystems died Tuesday. Joshua Dean, who lived in Wichita, Kansas, and was formerly a quality auditor for the company, had an infection that came on suddenly and quickly spread, the Seattle Times reported. He was 45. Dean's aunt, Carol Parsons, told the newspaper that he spent 2 weeks in critical condition. He had gone to the hospital after having trouble breathing and was later intubated and developed pneumonia and MRSA. Dean was among the first whistleblowers to allege that leaders at Spirit turned a blind eye to deficiencies in Boeing 737 MAX. He gave a deposition in a shareholder lawsuit filed last year and made a complaint with the Federal Aviation Administration. Our thoughts are with Josh Dean's family. This sudden loss is stunning news here at Spirit and for his loved ones, Spirit told USA Today in an emailed statement. Dean told the Wall Street Journal that he was fired after he pointed out misdrilled holes in fuselages. It is known at Spirit that if you make too much noise and cause too much trouble, you will be moved, he said in January. A Spirit spokesperson told the Journal at the time that the company would defend itself against the lawsuit and disagreed firmly with the allegations. Boeing whistleblower John Barnett, who had also raised concerns about manufacturing practices of the company, was found dead from what appeared to be a self-inflicted gunshot wound in March. The news comes as Boeing's safety culture is under intense scrutiny after a 737 MAX 9 lost a section of fuselage during a January Alaskan Airlines flight. Boeing CEO David Calhoun recently announced he will step down by the end of the year. Caitlin Clark to the Olympics. Aces will win third title. 10 bold predictions for the 2024 WNBA season. Lindsay Schnell, USA Today. The 28th WNBA season doesn't tip until May 14th, but with preseason games starting Friday, it's time to start thinking about what's in store for women's professional basketball the next few months. There's never been more excitement around the women's game. With a star-studded draft class, a team going for its third consecutive championship, and a Summer Olympics that will help drum up interest in women's basketball, the WNBA is headed into its most anticipated season since the league debuted almost three decades ago. So what can we expect this summer? Here are 10 bold predictions for the 2024 WNBA season. 1. Caitlin Clark will lead the WNBA in assists and make the Olympic team. Does this sound like much of a stretch? No. 1 overall pick, Caitlin Clark is the best name and face in the women's game right now, so putting her on the Olympic team, even if she doesn't play much, seems inevitable. And it'll be easier to justify when she comes in and distributes the ball to her teammates with flair. New York's Courtney Vandersloot led the league last year in assists with 8.1 per game, but Clark can top that merely because she has so many great options to pass to. From 2023 Rookie of the Year Ilea Boston to Kelsey Mitchell to Nalisa Smith and others. Defenders are going to be aggressive and physical with Clark, so it's likely she'll struggle to score at the clip she did in college. But her passing will translate immediately, especially in transition. 2. Los Angeles Sparks' Rekaya Jackson will be the 2024 Rookie of the Year. In the event that you're unfamiliar with Rekaya Jackson, the number 4 overall pick out of Tennessee, you should study up. The 6'2" guard forward has tremendous size to go along with her skill set, which means she'll make an immediate impact. Once more, the Sparks are in desperate need of some scoring. They lost their two top scorers in the offseason, and Jackson can provide that. She's smooth, fun to watch, and her personality will fit in perfectly in Hollywood. 3. Charter flights will become mandatory. Women's basketball has never been more popular, and while it's absurd that the WNBA is 28 years old and still not chartering regularly, especially after Brittany Griner's safety that was threatened upon her return from Russia, this is a problem that is likely to be fixed soon. By the time everyone returns from the Olympic break, August 14th, charters should be the norm in the WNBA. Members of the 2024 draft class, led by Clark, are so popular they're regularly going to get mobbed in airports. That's not going to go over well with anyone, and NBA Commissioner Adam Silver can step in and fix it with the snap of his fingers. Everyone associated with the WNBA, players, coaches, fans, want charters. Silver can and should make it happen. 4. This will not be Diana Taurasi's final season. A few important notes on the women widely and correctly considered the GOAT of the WNBA. Yes, Diana Taurasi has talked about wanting to get through the Paris Olympics, but Taurasi has an insatiable hunger for competition, and she's not ready to give up the sport she loves or the paycheck, even if she's dealt with more than her share of injuries lately. Taurasi played in just 26 of Phoenix's 40 games last season. She'll be around next summer, too, and very possibly after that as well. After missing the playoffs last season, it will be important to Taurasi to lead Phoenix back to the postseason before she bids goodbye. 5. The Las Vegas Aces will three-peat. Yes, the New York Liberty took Las Vegas to 4 games in the last finals, but let's be real. In the W right now, it's Las Vegas and everybody else. The Liberty might have the star power to match Las Vegas, but coach Becky Hammon has proved to be the difference. The Aces return their entire 2023 playoff roster, and Aja Wilson only keeps improving. No WNBA team has three-peated since the Houston Comets won the league's first 4 games from 1997 to 2000. That changes this summer. 6. Skylar Diggins-Smith will have an all-WNBA season with the Seattle Storm. The number 3 overall pick in the 2013 draft, Skylar Diggins-Smith has a reputation for bringing drama wherever she goes. But don't let the off-court rumors or antics take her away from her on the court play, which is often spectacular. Throughout her career, the 5'9 guard has averaged 16.7 points, 5 assists, 2.9 rebounds, and 1.3 steals per game. She's also a terrific defender. Diggins-Smith missed last season after giving birth to her second child, but her absence from the Phoenix Mercury went beyond that. Last August, Diggins-Smith said she had been barred from the team's practice facility. Diggins-Smith has a long history of playing well when people are dismissing her. 7. The WNBA will announce 3 expansion teams by the 2024 finals. Initially, the W planned to announce 2 expansion teams by the end of 2023, which would start playing the 2025 season. They got halfway there with the addition of the Bay Area team, which has already sold 7,000 season tickets. But the second team, which was reported to be Portland, fell through, and now the W is in a holding pattern. That means that as of now, the league is expected to play with just 13 teams in 2025. Commissioner Kathy Engelbert said during the 2024 draft that she's confident the league can get to 16 teams by 2028. Fans are clamoring for expansion right now, though, and while the WNBA drags its feet, the NWSL is naming expansion teams left and right. An easy way to fix all this? Name the next 3 cities by the finals, which will run through October. It really is that simple. Aja Wilson will win MVP honors. The vote won't be close. Speaking of the league's best player and the world's top player on both ends of the floor, Wilson has won back-to-back DPOY awards. The 27-year-old will be hungry to get her MVP trophy back this season. There was some controversy last season when Breanna Stewart took home MVP honors despite receiving fewer first-place votes than Connecticut's Elisa Thomas. In WNBA awards, voters ranked their choices. Wilson admitted that finishing third in 2023 MVP voting hurt like hell. In a bizarre move, someone even voted her fourth. She'll be anxious to flush that feeling and will go on a tear starting day 1. 9. Chicago will lead the league in rebounds. Don't believe this because I said it. Believe it because Camila Cardoso proclaimed it. On draft night, after Chicago selected South Carolina's Cardoso number 3 overall and LSU's Angel Reese number 7 overall, Cardoso joked of the Sky's imposing new front court. Nobody's going to get more rebounds than us. Except she wasn't kidding. Reese and Cardoso averaged 13.4 and 9.7 rebounds, respectively, in their final college season, which ranked 2nd and 41st nationally. Chicago averaged 33.3 rebounds as a team last year. With Reese and Cardoso in the lineup, expect that number to go up significantly. 10. Every New York Liberty starter will be an all-star. This is going to happen for 2 reasons. First, the Liberty is stacked with talent, from Breanna Stewart to Sabrina Ionescu to Courtney Vandersloot and more. But here's the other caveat that's important to know. This summer, the Olympic team will be playing the All-Star team before the Americans head to Paris. Because all the Olympians are likely to be voted All-Stars first, numerous All-Star roster spots will open up. That's how Jonquel Jones and Benija Laney Hamilton will also make the team.
This has been USA Today, and I'm Mickey Vandeleau. See you next week.